Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, looking into the brain for the origins of language and music, a sky watcher's treat for early birds, and the world's quietest room. Here's a scientist soundbite.
And in the case of music, the claim is that it doesn't sound like the terrestrial sterile events around us. It sounds like the most evocative event around us, namely the sounds of humans moving evocatively in our midst.
That's brain researcher Mark Changizi. More with him later, but first, science news of the week with Michael Brennan and Emily Howard.
A study led by the Karolinska Institute reports for the first time the positive effects of an active vaccine against Alzheimer's disease. The new vaccine, CAD-106, can prove a breakthrough in the search for the cure for this progressive brain disease, which slowly destroys memory and thinking skills. The study is published in the science journal Lancet Neurology.
Researchers have determined 98% of the genome of a human fetus using only a blood sample from the mom while pregnant and a saliva specimen from the dad. The University of Washington research team hopes their process will allow thousands of genetic diseases to be detected prenatally.
You might have heard recently that eating a 100-gram portion of shrimp cocktail is equivalent to burning 90 liters of gasoline. That story came out in early 2012 and was widely disseminated. But is it true? Dr. James S. Diana, director of the Michigan Sea Grant College program at the University of Michigan, says no. He's written a post at earthsky.org refuting this earlier announcement. In fact, he wrote, shrimp is no more environmentally harmful than other foods eaten as hors d'oeuvres in the U.S., for example, buffalo wings. To read his story, come to earthsky.org and search for the words shrimp cocktail.
Astronomers at Arizona State University have found an exceptionally distant galaxy, ranked among the top 10 most distant objects currently known in space. Light from the recently detected galaxy left the object about 800 million years after the beginning of the universe, when the universe was in its infancy. Astronomers say this remote galaxy will help them understand how galaxies like our Milky Way came to be.
In May, scientists at Yale University and the University of Colorado at Boulder released an online demonstration version of a new global map of life. The map depicts the locations of over 25,000 different species. The scientists are currently seeking feedback on how best to improve people's experience of using the map and on what new features would be the most valuable to add in the future. You can access the map at mappinglife.org. That's Science News of the Week. I'm Emily Howard.
And I'm Michael Brennan. Song of the Week this week is by musician Shaky Graves. He's a one-man band, plays guitar, sings, and plays a foot pedal on a suitcase and a tambourine. This song is called Roll the Bones.
Sell your belongings, all your clever drawings. Try to make a dollar from the grave. Roll the bones to the grave.
trouble all you like, yeah. Put up the fucking fight, they say that someday everybody dies alone. Yeah, struggle all you like, yeah. Put up the fucking fight, they say that someday everybody dies alone.
Sky, we interview the world's top scientists. Language and music seem so natural to our human species that we might think our brains are biologically wired or they evolved to process these sounds. But could it be that music and language evolved to fit our human brain? Evolutionary neuroscientist Mark Changizi makes this case in his book Harnessed: How Language and Music Mimic Nature and Transformed Ape to Man. Dr. Changizi is the director of human cognition at the Research Institute 2AI, and he's on the line now to explain his findings. Dr. Changizi, welcome.
Glad to be here.
What did you find are the origins of language and music?
Now, prior to doing this research, I had looked at how we came to read, and this is a case where we're not confused into thinking that we might have had a reading instinct. We know that we can't possibly have evolved to read because it's much too recent. So the story there was that the reason that we can read as well as we do, it's almost like it's an instinct and yet it's not, is that the shapes of writing have shaped themselves culturally over time to look like the kinds of conglomerations of contours that happen out there in nature amongst just the solid objects of our world. Your visual system is really good at processing those things out in nature. So letters have come to have those shapes, thereby turning your visual system, your object recognition system, into a reading system. So the thought was, could it be that even spoken language, could it be that it was invented, it's been around with us for 100,000 years rather than just several thousand years, could it be that it's been culturally evolving to shape the sounds of speech to be just the sort of thing that the auditory system is already great at processing, so that we never had to evolve specialized speech processing areas, just like we never had time to evolve specialized letter processing areas. So that's what motivated me to go down this line of saying speech has been around long enough for us to imagine that there may have been a long extended period of time where we were selected to have specialized, you know, speech recognition mechanisms, but maybe not. Maybe it's just been culturally evolving all this time and becoming fine-tuned for our ears. So the question here is, what might speech sound like that our ape brains already were good at? And just like in writing, the idea is it looks like just three-dimensional scenes with opaque objects strewn about, the thought here was, could it be that speech sounds like the other fundamental sounds of the terrestrial environment, which is just solid objects?
Well, Dr. Changizi, how did you do the research that went into your book, Harnessed? What did you measure and study?
Well, in all three of the cases, writing, speech, and music, and again, Harness is really about just the auditory side, speech, in all of these cases, the hypothesis is you're making a claim about what culture has evolved to shape these artifacts to be like. So you have to go out both to the cultural artifacts, the structure of writing, the structure of speech, or the structure of music, and you need to take measurements within those. But the predictions about what those structures should be are out in nature. So in the case of writing, the idea is, well, you've got to go out to nature and you say, look, the world is mostly filled with opaque objects strewn about. What kinds of patterns do you find amongst opaque objects strewn about in terms of the way the contours intersect? One has to theoretically and experimentally work out what are those kinds of contours, and then the prediction is, oh, we should find those in the structures of writing systems across humankind. For speech, one has to go out and say, look, solid objects, they make certain kinds of patterns of sounds. They hit, they slide, they ring, or periodically vibrate. Those are, for example, the plosives, the p, t, k, and the fricatives, f, sh, that sounds like slides, and then the sonorants of language. And then one has to say, well, what are the patterns in terms of how hits, slides, and rings interact among solid objects? And each time you can make a claim then you're in a position to make predictions about what the structure of speech should be like. And in the case of music, the claim is that it doesn't sound like the terrestrial, sterile events around us. It sounds like the most evocative event around us, namely the sounds of humans moving evocatively in our midst. People, when they move, they have a gait. They have a regular beat from their gait. They have other time-locked shuffles and other kinds of sounds that they make. That's the beat and rhythm of music. They have Doppler shifts by virtue of any movers around you always make subtle Doppler shifts that your ears are sensitive to that tell you the direction of the mover. That's the melody of music. As they get nearer or farther, the loudness modulations, when they happen in the real world, typically are due to proximity or distance of the mover. And so the pianissimos and fortissimos in music are telling you about the distance of the fictional mover that the music is telling you about. So you can work out like a theorem. You say, look, here's a regularity of what humans sound like when they move. Then you make a prediction that musics should have that structure. And so in the case of Harness, we have data mostly from just Western music, a very deep 10,000 themes from classical themes over 400 or 500 years, and there's another Finnish database from Finland, all folk songs, another 10,000 database. And so the idea is to focus on these data sets where we have a long history of music that has been strongly selected for over long periods of time, where we hope to get the strongest signal, in some sense, for the kinds of features that are being selected for. So that's the strategy. Going out to nature, going out to the cultural artifacts, and looking to find the similar structures in each.
Talk a little bit more about the origins of music. How did that get into our brains?
Many of us are terrible at producing. You know, producing music is something that I don't necessarily think has been well harnessed. But I would bet that it's even people who never develop any musical talent by the standards of society, when we say we don't have musical talent, are of course incredibly musically talented in the sense that they're incredible critics and processors of music, and they get music. They know the music that they like, and they may never be able to hit two notes in a row that sound good on the piano. And we can do this very, very early, that we can process music and feel it and understand it. And it has all of the signatures of instinct in this way that happens so early and so quickly. And it, of course, it can actually make us move, which is also one of the most mysterious parts of music. Why should any kind of strange stimulus of any kind, auditory, visual, incline us to start moving our bodies in rhythm to it? If music really sounds like what humans sound like when they move, and again, it doesn't mean that it entirely sounds like that. Let me back up for a second. When I do a smiley face, when I draw a smiley face with this, you know, the standard smiley face you see on T-shirts, it doesn't look at all like any human has ever looked that has smiled or otherwise. It's an extreme exaggeration. It has some of the fundamental features that make your visual system react in the way that is an exaggeration to what a typical smiley face. So the idea is that music has, from your lower auditory system, that is, you have a big hierarchy of auditory areas, just like we have hierarchy of visual areas, it has many of the structural features of what humans sound like when they move, but it's exaggerations of those features and abstractions of those features in such a way that your auditory system, your lower auditory system that you don't necessarily have conscious access to, is tracking a person moving around you, just like you're tracking in real life people moving around you, and you're never doing it consciously. And so it can really tell a very deep, evocative story. But again, it's not having anything to do with language. It's part of your auditory system's recognition mechanisms for other people, their behaviors, and the emotions that they have around you. And so it's inherently a very different sort of thing than language.
You've been listening to brain researcher Mark Changizi. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We're at Sky, broadcast on over 1,200 stations worldwide, including Voice of America. Many of us wish we had more quiet and solitude in our lives. In today's Weird Science, Ryan Britton is here to share how absolute quiet can affect us in weird ways.
Absolute quiet can actually drive you crazy.
Okay, how's that?
Well, to back up for a second, this story is about the anechoic chamber at Orfield Laboratories in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Now, anechoic means without echo. So this room is designed to absorb sound, and it does a very good job of it. In fact, it is in the Guinness Book of World Records as the world's quietest place. This chamber is designed to absorb 99.99% of all sound. It has sound insulation that's over a meter thick, plus two insulated steel walls, followed by a thick concrete wall that's close to a third of a meter thick.
Wow.
Yeah, and all of this material is to make sure that no sound outside gets in and that all the sound inside is absorbed.
It sounds kind of like a black hole of sound. Ryan, so this sound deprivation drives people crazy. What's happening?
We humans are used to having ambient noise around us. In other words, sound is normally all around us, even when it's quiet. So when there isn't any sound, our bodies become the sound. Without sound around us, we start to hear our breathing, our heartbeat, our swallowing. It's reported as being very, very strange. And also our ears, we use them to orient ourselves. So our hearing even aids us in standing upright. When sound is taken away, it's very disconcerting. People can get dizzy or, you know, have problems standing up. People who stay in the chamber are actually asked to sit down or lie down. In fact, the longest anybody has ever been in the chamber is 45 minutes.
Scary, yeah. I guess. So why have a place like this?
Well, besides going in to have hallucinations, which have been reported, it's also used for product testing. Manufacturers and companies rent the space to measure sound and vibration. I'd like to go experience it myself, see what my, I have a case of tinnitus, and from a life of rock concerts, I wonder what that sounds like in there.
I imagine it would sound loud, even though there's no sound.
Probably.
So where can people find out more about this anechoic chamber?
Yeah, anechoic chamber. There's a great tour of the space on YouTube, and you just search for Orfield, O-R-F-I-E-L-D, Labs. And they also, Orfield Labs has a site with a tour. There's also finally a good article on the chamber at indianexpress.com.
Sounds good, Ryan. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky's Ryan Britton. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird is here with news of the global night sky. A great time for early birds to skywatch. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, Jorge. Well, we've had so much going on in the evening sky that we've been neglecting the pre-dawn sky. So, Jorge, I want you to set your alarm for early in the morning before the sun comes up and get up early in the next week or so because there's some cool stuff to see.
Okay, so I'll set my alarm early morning. And this is something that, tell us who can see what. What's happening?
Well, so the first thing I want you to look for, Jorge, in these early mornings is the moon. And the moon is going to be at the last quarter phase on Monday, June 11th. The last quarter moon, we call it a quarter moon, but really it's that moon that you see that looks like half a pie. So it looks like a half in our sky, but we call it a last quarter moon. So that moon is up in the pre-dawn hours. And in fact, if you're up before dawn, you're going to see the moon any morning. But particularly on the morning of June 11th, you'll see the last quarter moon in the sky. And the last quarter moon is great to watch for because it marks the direction of Earth's motion in orbit. So Earth travels really fast in orbit. We travel at 18 miles per second, which is about 30 kilometers a second for our international audience. And so that's really fast. So it would just take a few hours for us to reach the moon at that rate of speed if you could anchor the moon in space. If you could anchor that last quarter moon in space and let Earth keep rushing along in orbit, Earth would reach the moon in just a few hours.
Now, that's a cool thought.
Yeah, it is. But that's not the only thing in the pre-dawn sky to look for.
Okay. So what else is happening for these early birds out there? Hopefully I can join, but what else is happening in the early morning?
Now, you said you'd set your alarm.
That's right.
So what else is happening is that the planets Venus and Jupiter are also up before dawn. And they can be seen around the entire world in the pre-dawn sky in the east. If you're in the northern hemisphere, this mid-June time of year also features the earliest sunrises of the year. And that's such a beautiful time to be out before dawn. So Venus and Jupiter are in the east. They're the two brightest planets. And so you can see them pretty close to the sunrise. So they'll be low in the eastern sky.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us.
This week's show was recorded at Earth Sky Studio B in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. There are too many.